Welcome to theconversation.org, making sense of these times.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be great.
This show is brought to you by MightyCompanions.org. And now your host, Suzanne Taylor.
This show is an unusual treat. We're taking you to the Mighty Companions living room, the salon, if you will, where for many years we've been holding events that have an intention of bringing us into the actual experience of ourselves as the potential that we are, or as the actuality that we are, creatures with a divine nature. For this show, I've gone back to an event that we held in December of 1992, but it could have been held yesterday. We've carved it up into two shows because it was an evening, and it was too long for one of our web radio shows. So we've carved it up into two pieces, and this will be part one of what we framed as a conversation between two great sages who come from very, very different traditions and who are comparing notes here. And what you'll see is how beautifully the perspectives dovetail, because of course, underneath all the differences in surface form, all true paths, all true sacred paths or stories are really dealing with the same material. And they'll all get you home, whatever it is you have an affinity for. If you get on that track and pursue it with diligence, every one of those tracks will get you home, because they all are about home. They're evocations of the universe of home, where you and the cosmos are one. We framed this particular evening as a conversation about true power. True power being who you really are expressed into the universe. And the two sages are Lex Hickson, about whom you can find out much more on our website. We have the nicest pages on the web about Lex Hickson, who was our incredibly wonderful ally for a few years before his death in 1995, his very early death, age 53. The world lost something when it lost Lex Hickson. He was a rare soul who held spiritual lineage in five different sacred traditions. Out of his own perspective, that each of them was a parallel path to the same place. And he loved the tradition and the ritual, and he didn't want to mix them. He didn't want there to be one universal way, because they're beautiful. It's like having different countries and different languages, and look at this rich array that we have in the world, which makes it all very juicy. And in fact, as these paths play off against one another, you really can see with greater clarity how there is just one essential story. You're not being sold some bill of goods about the way. In fact, it looks like many ways, but you get to see that they're all echoes of the same essential truths. Georgia Lambert is an awesome person, a Renaissance woman, and you'll hear that on the tape. You'll hear some reflection of what an unusual female she is. She's a very female, but she's a very powerful person with lots of, we might call, male energy. What you won't hear on the tape is that she's a brilliant painter. Her stuff looks like Rembrandt, and it's full of sacred symbologies. Very interesting pictures. And here she is, a teacher of the wisdom. Many things have come out of the wisdom, which we might identify most readily as the Alice Bailey material. But the theosophy people, the Christian Science people, the Science of Mind people, they're all branching off from the wisdom, which posits that there's a kind of a science of consciousness. It doesn't go in the mystical direction, it goes in the quote-unquote occult direction. Occult not meaning sinister, but occult meaning mysterious and hidden, and scientific, essentially, where the meditations are not intended to create a union in some way in which there is a leap or a grace where you connect with your divine source, but you actually go through a process of building an alignment that is the bridge to the divine. And Georgia and Lex were two figures in the pantheon of Mighty Companions who actually figured prominently in a group that we held for a year, where we met regularly, and it was a circle of teachers. Willis Harmon, who was the president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, helped start this group. He suggested to me a few years ago that the world would need power groups. We were coming into difficult times, and he would help me start one in Los Angeles. And this is what we started. Willis came down a few times to sit with us. Willis Harmon, another great being, who, along with Lex Hickson, held the whole world in his perspective, trying to see what could be done to shift it all, rather than working in some tradition or with some process that was working to accomplish something in a narrower band. These two individuals were quite unusual and unfortunately left us among the rare people who were trying to juggle the whole of reality. Interestingly enough, here in my living room, before either of them got sick, in one of our evenings, they had a conversation about the fact that there is no quote-unquote death in that perspective in which we are all eternal. And then shortly after that, they both got sick and died. It didn't contradict their conversation, because there they are, eternal beings. But it was just interesting on the mundane plane that here I have them actually on videotape having this particular conversation, and then both of them left their bodies. A great loss, and it's hard to find other figures who are trying to take such a big bite and doing it so beautifully. But here now, back to the worker bees, us, to come together in some kind of alignment, which is what Mighty Companions is all about, to create a force for the good. We hearken to the Margaret Mead quote that's everywhere. Never doubt that a small band of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And our salons are not lighthearted events to tell us a little more of this and that, but really are, as all the activities of Mighty Companions are, attempts to evoke that alignment among a small group of people that could form a powerful enough beacon or pebble in the pond of humanity that could ripple out and include everyone. I stand on the shoulders of Lex and of Willis, understanding that it is up to the circle now. It feels like an evolution where individuals are not going to be our saviors, and perhaps Lex and Willis might have been such figures in some most current version of what that energy is, but maybe perhaps we don't even get that anymore. Maybe it really is up to this more democratized reality. Jim Drever, who's on one of our earlier shows and is another of our allies, calls it the democratization of enlightenment. And I like to talk about everyday God. It's here for all of us now, looking in each other's eyes. So this evening that we're going to be presenting to you, I've gone back and edited this living room conversation about true power. In some instances, I've had to cut things because they were too far from the microphone to even pick up, so some of the sound may be a little jumpy. Bear with us, because I think you will find, as I said, this is just as timely a conversation now as it was in 1992. There's real guidance here for all of us as to what the intention of life is and to what the processes might be that will get us to this intention. There's a real teaching here, and a real invitation to take up the challenge of being a worker for the light. You are a point of causality in the world, not just a sponge, as Georgia will say. And our capacity to be at cause, as she also will say, is a function of us discovering that the soul is our everyday experience. So with great pleasure, I bring you Lex Hickson, Georgia Lambert, and a conversation with the Mighty Companions about true power.
Here we are, huddled in this new conversation, and the conversation that we're initiating tonight, actually, here in these auspices of what we do, which we call Mighty Companions, is a conversation about true power. The conversation we were having heretofore, we were labeling, something is happening. And we had months of evenings in the living room discovering what was happening. And I think what was happening was the emergence of true power. So this is the official beginning to that inquiry.
Something's happening, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. John?
One umbrella for all of this, as I speak about and as I think about this unified field of consciousness that we could become, what I said to Lex, whatever I said to him about whatever we would do tonight, oh, and I asked him to do me a favor and to do something, and he said, I would do anything for you. I said,
anything?
Well, I didn't really pursue that because I had quite some thoughts that I didn't think would... Perhaps I should lay out on the table. However, I love...
Lay it all out on the table.
Really. I love that he said that to me. And I thought, that community that would gather in some unified field of consciousness, everybody in that community would say that to one another. So that would be sort of my contextual dream for how it could be in the largest picture and what we move ourselves towards. So, true power, a couple of remarks. Obviously, it's not something you possess, it's something that you are. And my sense of the kernel of it, which can get amended and changed and spoken to this evening, is that true power, I speak of it as us as human beings outpicturing our souls, not our personas, but our souls, fashioning the path of the soul. And as we do that, we are in the continuum of what I would call true power. I wanted to read you a couple of little blurbs that...
Let me make a comment on that one thing.
Oh, good.
That's beautiful what you said, that since it's not something we possess, therefore it's something what we are. So if that's what I mean, is that I would do anything for her with what I am. It's not a question of like, you know, help her buy a Ferrari or something like that. I would give anything to her from what I am. That would be my definition of it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I could say that to all of you too. I hope you could say it to me.
Could you say more about it, Lex?
Later, maybe.
The empowerment that I get from that is my sense of how we pass true power around. So I have a couple little blurbs to read from you of other people's. A woman named Maestra Slade, who in our last monthly packet, she had a 2 pages of a map of her reality, which I think is a map of a power reality. But she says this little provocative thing, and I just want to throw it in as a question. In fact, if she'd only said this, I wouldn't be doing it because I love her map. And now inside her map, she says this, and I don't know about this. So the sooner that a significant number of humanity wakes up, the fewer earth changes and shifts there will be. For then earth will not need to keep either ringing the alarm clock as a wake-up call or rebalancing its energy to compensate for massive human negativity by creating fires, floods, droughts, earthquakes, and the like. Question. I'm not sure about that. I mean, I'm really not sure about that. Is that true? What do we think about that? Okay. Alexander, channeled by a man named Ramon Stevens, always sends out material that thrills me. One of the clearest voices that I enjoy, and I frequently reprint bits and pieces of what he says. So here's what he has to say that I thought I'd toss out. 2,000 years later, you stand at the cusp of another sudden acceleration. Yet the difference is that you are not refining Western culture's traditional worldview. You are abandoning it. The transition from a world in which God, fate, or dumb luck rule your lives to one in which each individual creates his or her own reality is not a crawl, but a leapfrog over a very deep chasm. There is no smooth transition between the two worldviews. The old must be jettisoned for the new to take root. I think that's an interesting thought to play with.
Objection.
Okay. Objection. I didn't say it was, you say it was true. I said it was the play with. You want to object now? Go ahead.
No. As long as it's recorded. No objection.
Well,
from the actors.
Okay. He talks in this piece about super consciousness, the next great leap, that we are...
There's a dual anchor of
action. That our core vibration is indeed changing from outer worship to inner embodiment. And that's what I learn all the time in George's class. So that would be good food for conversation. Okay. And then I want to read you a little Deepak Chopra, who's everybody's favorite these days, and no wonder, is that man on it. God, he is so good. This is just one sentence that turns me on because it reminds me of crop circles. Anybody who hangs out around here knows that we're very turned on by crop circles. So he says, quantum physics is not only stranger than we think it is, and he was talking about what's beyond the outer edge of the universe, questions like that, and the answers that quantum physics is coming up with. So he says, quantum physics is not only stranger than we think it is, it's stranger than we can think. So crop circles, hello. And then I want to read you about...
It's better than we can think.
Little, oh good. So I want to read you a little quote to the subject of power that Chopra says. He says, most people have a time-bound awareness. The reason is that they've sacrificed their self, big self, for their self-image, our social persona, the protective veneer, the mask behind which we hide. The self-image is intellectual. It calculates. It determines its behavior in anticipation of other people's responses. It is a fear-based, time-bound awareness. On the other hand, self feels. It is from the heart. Self has a built-in response to every situation as it occurs, a harmonious response, he goes on to say, obviously. The awareness of the self is supremely concentrated in the present. So some elements of what power might be. That seems to me are some thoughts about what, you know, but now what about how? How do we make this contact? As Georgia says, that what we are up to in class, at least, is to lift the consciousness bit by bit out of the area where the emotion is in control into that area of mind where truth formulated into thought is the controlling factor in the life and affairs. So I invite tonight, I wrote down some words as we move along here in this realm of true power, ideas, understandings, tips, practices, teachings, games, maps, processes, investigations, testimony that deals with true power. These things are being sought.
Or true power itself.
Touche. Well, one thing you can do for me, Lex, is be smarter than me.
No.
Anytime.
No. None of your friends will listen to that.
Oh, I meant it very positively. Okay. So now I have a question for you, and it's actually a question I got from Chopra, so I can't lie. So the question for each of you is this the best time of your life? So I want you to think about that.
Yes.
Let's have a show of hands. I want to see the hands of people who would say this is the best time of your life.
Well, it depends how you want to look at it.
Depends how you want to look at it, yeah. Well, not to keep you in suspense, the intelligence that Chopra is dealing with is his perception, and maybe it's the perception, we can get on with talking about that too, that judgment deprives you of life, of happiness, of power. Judgment is any place where you make things better or worse. And if you can't say yes to this being the best time of your life, judgment is still playing a part it ideally would not be playing in your life. And in fact, let's listen to a little Chopra. I queued up 2 minutes.
The judging mind has been so ingrained in deferring experience that even its moments of deepest happiness are shadowed by the prospect of something better or something worse. Something I wish I hadn't done. Something I want to do but can't. And this brings in the role of using judgment as defense. We all defend ourselves with self-justification, knowing deep down that we cannot face the risk of asking for total happiness. We say things like, I'm too busy now, I'll be happy when I'm successful. Today's not a good day, I'll be happy tomorrow. I can't be happy with you, you're not up to my standards. I'll be happy when I get what I want. How often have we used such phrases to justify a basic sense of self-defeat? In each rationalization, one hears the victory of the head over the heart. The heart's most fundamental desire to be content in the here and now, without doubt or equivocation, has been denied. The experience of being happy is no longer immediate. It has become a distant or near prospect, an idea rather than a feeling. The trap of judgment is that one begins to believe that such self-imposed limitations is completely justified.
I think we can do better than this ourselves.
Okay, so you can turn it off there. So now I want to move on to introduce Georgia and Lex and to tell you a little bit about both of them. You don't want to be introduced?
No, don't introduce her. I said too much already.
No.
Never, darling. I would do anything for you, too, so it goes both ways.
We're just meeting for the first time tonight, Georgia and I. We recognize each other.
First thing I want to tell you about Lex is I've known him a long time, not well. We're getting to know each other well in this phase of our lives. But I knew him long enough ago that he gave me this copy of Coming Home, the original. The publisher of the reissue is Jeremy Tarcher, who's here tonight.
That was sold for $2.50.
One of my all-time favorite books. And Lex writes in it for Suzanne. We didn't know each other well. We brushed by each other. I can't quite remember how. But for Suzanne, with solidarity along the mysterious way. In spiritual friendship, Lex. And the funny thing that I want to show you about this is that it was so long ago that I got this book. As you all came in the door, you may not have noticed, and I'm not going to... Mark, hold up that big sign. We're not going to read it. Just hold it up. Years ago when I produced the project and I wanted to turn everybody on to the possibilities of our mutuality, I pulled some quotes from this book and I had that sign made. You can all look at it later. But I want to tell you how long ago that was. In order to take that down to the place that made the thing, they didn't have Xeroxes then. So I had to cut the book out to paste it up so that I could get that. So my book has a few little holes in it.
She hasn't seen the new edition yet.
Jeremy, I need another one. Okay. Now, we are very blessed today. This is yesterday's weekly. My Lunch with Lex. Written by Michael Goldberg. Where's Michael?
You got this there.
Okay, Michael's over there. This is a wonderful piece. It's really hard in just a few columns to get somebody's essence down. Lex hasn't seen the piece, so he may disagree with me. But I thought it was a magnificent, magnificent piece. In the Weekly, I mean, it's the best thing I ever saw in the Weekly.
It came out of this place. We all, the conversation was here. The lunch was here.
Yeah. So well, it starts out.
The
fact that
Suzanne.
The first two words are, Suzanne called. Lex was back in town. Okay, you won't let me make a fancy introduction, then I won't. So that's enough for Lex. Now, the juxtaposition of putting Lex and Georgia in these chairs, I thought was just about perfect. Lex, we play with God with Lex, but it's never pretentious, and it's never somebody having any authority. It's just, that's what happens. So to me, when you come into Lex's space, you come to what he's up to, and that's what you do. Georgia has this incredibly wonderful class called The Nature of the Soul, several years of study, understanding the whole map of reality, a map of reality, that turns me on about who I am, who you are, who we are, what's going on, the plan, how it is unfolding, what our jobs are. And so, obviously, inside that plan, the best thing you could do would be play as God. So I thought, well, how perfect, the teacher of the plan and the embodiment of the spirit and the soul. Not that both of them don't do both jobs, but I thought this was just a perfect anchoring for this evening. So, let me see if I left anything out that I don't want to leave out for sure.
That got very profound all of a sudden.
I have actually finished with my introductory remarks, and I'm going to suggest that Georgia and Lex say some things, and then let's orchestrate this ourselves. This is not meant to be a lecture. It's really an opportunity for us, hopefully, to have a conversation. As it unfolds, whatever those questions are that you have in mind and those knowings that you have in tow, let them come into the room and let us all be really comfortable with whatever this is, because it's not a formal presentation, because it doesn't have the parameters that a regular evening would have. Let's all just be very comfortable hanging out with it. It can't be bad and it can't go wrong, and yet we don't really know what we're going to do. So I invite us all to, sit in the circle and be responsible for how we evolve this exploration of true power.
The subject this evening is one of power. But I think before we can talk about what real power is, which inevitably leads to the soul, we have to kind of look at, as you put it earlier, what's going on here. I think that everybody is aware that a tremendous synthesis is taking place, and it's being described in all kinds of different ways. A synthesis between East and West, right brain, left brain, yin-yang, masculine, feminine, whatever. The difficulty with this will to synthesis is that people don't understand that it is a synthesis in consciousness, not necessarily in form. And so people fall into the trap of thinking, well, if we just make all the forms homogenized and the same, we'll have a wonderful world. If everything is one religion, ours of course, one political system, ours of course, it'll be wonderful. We have to begin to understand that first and foremost, this synthesis has to do with something above and beyond the form. The form's job is to be different. It's not supposed to be all the same. Every person, every nation, every identity has its own unique gifts and talents to give to the world. When light is broken through a prism, it makes various colors, and then those are broken into more, and then more, and then more. And so the one life manifests through a diversity of form. The form is supposed to be diverse. What we have to do is find a way to be okay with that diversity. And listening to the comment here about judgment, I would like to interject the difference between discrimination and judgment. Judgment is just basically bitching without doing anything about it. Discrimination is being able to see the areas that need work, the areas that need to be lifted, the areas that need soul infusion, and to take the responsibility to do something about it. Generally, I try to steer away from this good, bad kind of place that so many New Agers altruistically but inevitably fall into. When people ask me if I'm an optimist or a pessimist, I usually respond with the concept that I'm a realistic idealist and let them figure it out. The syntheses that we're seeing today are what I would call horizontal synthesis. Synthesis of things that are already here. But power comes from a different kind of synthesis, and that is a vertical synthesis. It begins interiorly, but it must eventually be worked out exteriorly. And this, I think, is the keynote of the age into which we're moving. The training of the last age had to do with internal development, that matter was bad, the bodies were bad, build your own way out of it, get out of here to nirvana as quickly as possible. That produced a lot of necessary things within humanity. But now, the whole idea is to bring heaven to earth, to not only reach up to touch that divinity through prayer, through meditation, through whatever, but to experience that, and instead of the Grail Knight achieving the Grail and then disappearing out of this dimension, today we have the symbol of Aquarius, which is the Grail Knight, which achieves the Grail and then brings it back and pours it outward in service to his brothers. I think something that's lacking in a lot of the New Age movement is the idea that soul awareness is not just the soul overshadowing. To become more and more sensitive to the soul means not to build your way out of here in some interior ivory tower. Much of the soul is within the hearts of our brothers, and that soul is still imprisoned and in pain. So it's not for us to withdraw from the world or protect ourselves from the negativity of the world or pretend that it isn't there and that we don't see it and it doesn't exist. Our job is to do something about it. And the empowerment to do something about it comes from our own alignment with the overshadowing soul, to produce that synthesis between that which overshadows and that which indwells. And that marriage then empowers us to do our work in the world. And that's my opinion.
It's really important to find someone who's thought about these things at great length, because usually we thought a lot more about the Clinton campaign than we have about the nature of the soul. And it's not our fault, it's that maybe it's also part of our culture. I think 100 years ago, people used to think more about the soul. And when people were coming in this evening, I thought maybe most people thought that the soul was an outmoded type of thinking, or else it would be that fruitful to discuss. But what Georgia said, and I promised everyone that she would unfold the nature of the soul. Thank God that she did it. Is everyone perceiving through their eyes right now?
That's a funny question.
Or is everyone?
No.
How are you perceiving?
I?
Yeah, well, we're the anchors. You're the speakers.
I feel an enormous positive energy that's more than the sum of the parts that is physical. And it's rare.
Would that be soul perception? Is there soul perceiving that?
Well, there's a very large spiritual lift here.
I think maybe we could define a little bit this word soul, because everyone seems to have their own concept of it. I think if you ask most people on the street, what is the soul, they would answer in some vague way. Well, I think I have a soul, but I'm not sure where it is, and I'm not sure what it is, but I know it's good, and it kind of overshadows me, I hope. And that's about it.
I doubt if they've used the word overshadow.
Yeah, you're probably right.
It's around here somewhere.
It's a beautiful word, overshadow, used that way. That word is used in another, you know, when we say a more brilliant person overshadows another or something. Or older sister overshadows a younger sister. Could you say what you mean by overshadowing? That might be helpful.
Overshadowing is sort of a frequency that is above form as we know it. That when I say that the soul overshadows the persona, that in coming into incarnation, the soul, just above form as we know it, extends a thread of itself down into matter. And that thread of itself then, being magnetically attracted, takes on mental matter and that becomes its mind. It takes on emotional matter and that becomes its emotional or astral body. It takes on physical matter and that becomes its physical body. But the soul remains somewhat overshadowing, that is, above form, and doesn't have much communication with the personality except at birth and death, until the personality reaches a point of being almost finished. And at that point, it can be of real use to the soul. And in that point, it becomes the vessel through which the soul can work. Finally, which is why in the ancient mystery teachings, before they taught anything esoteric, you were given training in all of the arts and sciences that were known at the time. If you think of the Greek schools, for instance, you have a picked embodiment of this. The persona of and by itself doesn't have a purpose. And that's why nothing out here can fulfill that purpose that we know is within inside ourselves.
Persona means mask in Greek.
Exactly. It's the mask or the face.
Well, a mask has a purpose, but it doesn't have an ultimate substance.
Right. So the soul then overshadows the persona until the persona gets finished enough where the soul begins to move into the persona and pull the persona up toward itself. And at that point, the persona begins the path, as it were, begins to seek, and there begins this communion. And the soul no longer overshadows, but begins to descend as the persona is trained, refined, lifted up to meet it. And this results in that divine marriage that is talked about by so many different world systems, whether it be the Rosicrucian marriage of Christian Rosencrantz, the alchemical marriage of the red and white, the Shakti Shiva. It's talked about in every system. And so overshadowing means it holds the ultimate purpose in kind of a solution until the form is ready to receive it. And I think that's where humanity is. We're on the brink of that.
Does anyone in this room not feel that they're involved in this marriage? But is it a rare experience? I mean, this is why I come to this place. I'm happy to meet people here who I feel are involved in all sorts of practical matters. They're not recluses. They're not like exclusive contemplatives. But they have some real connection with this marriage between the persona and the soul. This is a place of marriage. This is a place of mystic marriage. The question is, are we a rare few, or
no.
Is it happening everywhere?
Everybody who smiles and projects love is in that perfect harmony with himself. They pass in and out of that phase at different times. But every time we smile and share love, we are in perfect marriage and perfect harmony.
There's a place in the meditation that we do of George's where we say we are part of a vast network of world servers now coming into resonation. That's not the word you use. What's the word you use?
Taking shape.
Taking shape upon this planet, yeah. And every time I say that in my meditation, I just get the sense that, you know, this is not the only living room. And You know, at some level, sometimes I feel lonely and lost, and not lost inside, but like, where is everybody in the rest of the world, so to speak? Even my New Age friends all over who seem to do strange things that don't seem to be like this. But whenever I do that meditation, yes, this really is happening.
Well, I think that's the exact point. When you are in it, it's happening. And then you're at the level of existence where that is what's happening, and that's where you feel the host of similar occurrence. And on another level, where you would be asking the question, you're on another level, in your head asking the question, wondering, having a mental exploration rather than an experience. I mean, my experience is that it used to be a lot more esoteric. And actually, Les, when you said something about the people or them and the rest of the people, that actually hurt when you said that, because I used to feel very much like that, you know, there was people who were conscious and people who were spiritual and then people who weren't. And I don't feel that separation anymore. I feel it is happening. And it's happening hearts and souls and in consciousness and in discussions, but much more happening in experience than the way it used to happen when we were so theosophical and cultural and literary and intellectual about it, which I think is a nice heritage, but we're past, I think, that state.
I think that the soul is being born within humanity. I don't think we have any choice about it. I think that our choice is to be the best midwives we can. And the baby's going to be born, whether the mother's in a field or in the hospital or whatever. If we are good midwives to this whole process, then there's the least amount of difficulty in terms of humanity en masse.
In your map, do you have the Holy Spirit functioning any place in your particular map? Or is it just the soul, just the drama that the soul is going through?
No. I think if we look in any world religion, we find a trinity, which has been described in a variety of different ways. Father, son, and mother, spirit, soul, and body, Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu. There's many, many ways of describing this trinity. And I think that in the look at power tonight, if I use this example all the time, a bar magnet, where you have the positive pole would be the father aspect or spirit or cause. The negative or receptive pole would be mother, matter, Holy Ghost, substance, appearance, form. And the soul intermediates between the two, that the soul is that magnetic field which relates spirit to matter and brings in that overshadowing plan, as Jesus said, the Father's business. In Masonic terms, this would be the blueprint on the trestle board of the Grand Architect. Humanity's job as a creative organ of the planet is to bring that plan into manifestation. We have to empower ourselves before we can properly do that. So this marriage of the soul and persona that is beginning to take place is but the first stages of an eventual outpicturing of what you could call spirit.
And what's beginning to take place is the awareness.
I think that the marriage as a potential has always existed. I think only now is it beginning to actually unfold down here in physical dense.
Physical dense?
Yes.
Yeah.
This stuff.
Density.
Yeah, density. I think that...
I wonder how dense it really is.
Yeah. Well...
We have to ask our Buddhist brothers.
That's
to
true. I think that each age has its own unfolding of the wisdom. One of the synthesis that we're seeing right now is the synthesis of the mystic approach and the occult approach. The mystic approach has traditionally been one of the soul is all wonderful, all perfect, all we have to do is open up and be what we already are. And this is a theme that's colored many, many different systems. The occult approach is, yes, the soul is all perfect, but that perfection has to be worked out down here. And so what we're seeing is a blending of the head path and the heart path, or the occult approach and the mystic approach. I don't think anyone can travel it alone anymore.
And the occult approach, another word you can use for that is tantric, the tantric approach. I mean, the occult sounds kind of maybe strange to our ears, but that, right. That could be called the tantric approach.
Right. And so I think, you know, to answer you specifically, the marriage has not taken place. It's a potential. But the actual full blending of that consciousness which is the soul with the consciousness which is humanity is now beginning to really unfold. Because humanity, since its long dim dark history from its beginnings, is now at that place where it has a developed physical vehicle, it has a developed emotional nature, and it's beginning to develop its mind. It's at that stage where it's being finished off and is now of use to the soul. So there is that coordinated effort as never before. There's always been the mysteries. There's always been the seekers. There's always been ways to it, but never in the mass scale that's happening today.
What about the great Mahayana kingdoms in India, for instance? Do you feel that those were just little forerunners of the major thing that's going to be happening now?
I think that both in the East and in the West, there have always been times where there have been what's called in some texts points of isolated light, which have come in through great teachers and avatars, which have stimulated great civilizations and have anchored the potential for divinity. And each one is like a bead on that string of pearls that has its own particular quality. But now we're at that critical mass that, in the new terms, the quantum leap or the 100th monkey thing, where it can't be denied by the masses anymore that they are being affected by it. And they are moving into it, sometimes kicking and screaming all the way. That's why we have so much stir-up today. The old forms are literally fighting for their survival because they know that their days are numbered, the old religious forms, the old political forms, the old social economic forms. Matter doesn't fuss as long as it's in control. It's only when it's about to be changed that it fights for its survival. See, the soul doesn't need the will to survive. It's immortal. Matter, substance, has the will to survive. And so all of the old structures and the old forms that have outpictured man's will up to this point are sensing this change, and they're trying to toe in for the last ditch effort at holding on to their territory. But regardless of how difficult that seems, or when we look at, you know, the political structures of the world, the overshadowing soul of humanity has built all of this. And no matter how strong any of this seems to be, it says nothing in relationship to the power of the soul to claim its form. And that's one of the things that's happening. In the last age, the only areas that were legitimate spiritually to move into was religion and philosophy, pretty much. Because the teaching in East and West was that the world was bad, matter was bad, the bodies were bad, beat them into submission and get rid of them. But now, disciples of many different lines are going back not only into philosophy and religion, but into politics, into business, to reclaim these lines in service to that Christ in all of us.
Isn't that then involution of spirit into matter?
You see, it's again this either-or, involution, evolution, in-breath or out-breath. Play with this image for a minute, okay? If you could imagine an hourglass with the top part of the hourglass spiraling in this way. When it gets to that neck of the hourglass, then it reverses itself and spirals this way. Everybody can mentally get that image. But now, in your little computers inside, take that hourglass and turn it on its end so you're looking at it this way. What you're seeing is a movement in and a movement out at the same time. And that symbol of the circle with the concentric circles is not only an Eastern drawing of the Om, but it was also the first drawing of the Kabbalistic tree. And its meaning is both the in-breath and the out-breath going on simultaneously.
So not the point at which they meet, but going on simultaneously. So that's a completely another form. We're talking about something that's a synthesis of duality. It's a resolution of duality.
It's a resolution because we're talking about the overshadowing life claiming its instrument and at the same time the instrument being lifted to carry the wattage of that new thing.
Oh, this is nice.
And that's why meditation is never a one-way street. It's not just listening to the soul or that which overshadows. It's a becoming that begins as a two-way process.
In fact, it's not something to indulge in too much, meditation.
And how are you defining it?
It tends to be a sort of ascension. What my sister is speaking about is the divine descent. So that when you sit there meditating, you straighten your spine, you're you sort of are automatically putting this world aside to some extent. And she's saying that the drama now is that the spirit or the soul is coming into the world.
But it depends on how you define meditation.
Yeah.
This whole experience to me is a very beautiful, cohesive meditation of sharing hearts, and that's not an individual experience.
That descent part is so important because, again, the idea that so many people have about the spiritual path is that it is a withdrawal. And a lot of people, in looking at any process of initiation, only see the first phase of it. Initiation is always a three-phase process. It is the consciousness opening up to the new thing. Most people think that's it. If that was it, all we'd have to do is write all the good stuff down in books, make sure everybody reads the books, and we'd have a changed humanity. Exposure does not mean expertise. So the first stage is the consciousness opening up to the new thing. That's the easy part. Then the personality has to get used to that new thing, and then the personality has to embody that new thing. We have to be able to perform it down here. That as we reach up, it is not for a withdrawal, it's to increase our range. And however high we go, that's also the relationship of our service out here into humanity. And that is not something we do, I think it was said earlier beautifully, it's something that we are.
I think I've often felt that that's the difference between knowing something and taking in all the nuances of its meaning, realizing it. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell whether the me making something real or experiencing something real or real making me, I don't know who's doing it when there's a realization. It's just a process.
In Zen, they distinguish actualizing from realizing.
And how do they do that?
They say that someone may have realized a lot of koans, but they haven't actualized them.
No. Oh, I think I meant them the same.
I see. But realize is a very real stage. I mean, it's really realizing. It's not just knowing something piecemeal. So that, let's say some of our Zen masters, I mean, most of them have been males, you know, that sort of gone off the deep end. You know, what has happened there? It may have something to do with the male ego, I don't know. But it also has to do with the fact that you can realize things in spiritual life. Really realize them. You can really realize koan. You can actually truly respond and show that you know a koan, but you haven't been able to actualize that in your social life, your family life, your community life.
Actualizing is when you embody them.
Embody them, not just like isolated, like saying I'm embodying move right now, but actually embodying it, not just in a situation like this, which is actually a very easy situation because we're all having a wonderful discussion on this high level. But what about in our own life, our family lives, and our own workspaces? That's actualization in that sense.
And I would like to really underscore that because it has to be worked out in the daily life. You've got to be able to live this stuff. It's okay to study, and that's wonderful, but if it can't be worked out down here,
it's a hobby.
Exactly.
You're talking about the three different aspects. Because we are in physical form, does that mean that we are an aspect of the mother aspect, of that divine intelligence aspect?
No, we're a trinity too. We have a point of spirit that in so many different texts they talk about God as being a divine fire, and that this divine fire differentiated itself into a myriad of divine sparks called in theosophical texts the monad. That is our point of spirit, the jewel in the heart of the lotus that links us with the father aspect. Our soul or awareness of being, our consciousness, links us with the sun or Christ aspect. And our form nature, of which the physical is only a part, because when we're talking about the astral body or the emotional nature and the mental body, we're still talking about matter. So that form links us then with the mother or Holy Ghost aspect. So we are in ourselves a hologram, a mini trinity, if you like.
Just remember, she has a map. That's the main thing. And don't say, well, do I agree with this map? Would I map it differently? I think we're here to say that someone is presenting a map of the soul. And that is one of the important things that we have to do, people in this world, and maybe even people who are concerned about bringing to birth into a new world. And so I think that's the exciting thing, rather than maybe I could feel some people listening to her map and sort of picturing how they would make their map differently. Right. Let's not get into those differences. Let's say there may be a different map for everybody here. But the point is there are maps. Mapping is possible. And something that we thought was maybe an old superstition, a myth, or even not worth thinking about, suddenly becomes a very, very rich thing to think about.
That's really important, because the words aren't important, and the constructs that we use to work it out for ourselves are not the same for everybody. That everybody has to find their own way to the top of the mountain, and the base is very wide, and there's lots of places to start, but the top's all the same. And as you get up toward the top, you get closer to one another. So, for instance, I find that when I'm talking to different groups, if people don't like to use the word karma, I like that because it's nice and short. But if I'm talking to a Christian community, I won't use that word because it's an immediate turnoff. And so I'll say, well, as you sow, so shall you reap. Or if I'm talking to a group of scientists, it's, you know, Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Karma is a lot shorter to say.
If you're talking to a group like this, you really should lead a meditation.
Right. So the words aren't...
forget to do that.
Yes, the words aren't important, and the mental constructs aren't important. It's the meaning that is important. And part of the difficulty with the metaphysical and esoteric community is that there's a language barrier. There's a big language barrier, and everybody thinks that, you know, their particular construct is the one and only one, and metaphysical groups should be above this. We see it in Orthodox religion, but if you look at psychic circles or metaphysical circles, it's like it's Atlantean class reunion time, right? So we get past the words and take a look at what's behind the words, the meaning behind the words.
So why don't take us there? Why don't take us in a meditation so we can actually get into that kind of thing. For 24 days we could talk about it on this level. But we need to have it take it to another level.
Do you want to do that now, or
sure.
Does anybody else want to?
Because it will give us more data. It will give us more data to think about.
This has been the first part of the conversation about true power with Lex Hickson and Georgia Lambert. We invite you now to listen to part two of the evening by clicking on the player of your choice on the show's webpage. This show is brought to you by MightyCompanions.org.